Ask Dr. Dawn is produced by Jiva Media at the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, discussion, dialogue, and health in the news. Before we go any further, let me remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. In just a few minutes, I'll be giving out the numbers, and I would love to hear from you. If you want to get in line now, that's fine, but I have to start out with a wonderful feature for Mother's Day and, well, basically a great family outing for all. This is going to be around for a few more weeks, I think, at the Camden Community Center in San Jose. You may want to call and find out how many weekends it's going to be there. I don't have that information. It's a giant 40-foot colon. It's 4 feet high, so if you want to go through it as a grown-up, you'll have to crawl on your hands and knees, experiencing, well, a bird's-eye view of something most of us don't even like to think about. But the colon is intended to educate people about colorectal cancer, which kills 57,000 Americans each year, but is 90% preventable through early detection. So what do we do about that? We build a giant colon, cost more than $10,000, and it's named Coco, the colossal colon. I have to stop. I just have to stop. Anyway, it's at the Camden Community Center in San Jose, and I'm going to make a side trip this weekend, I think, if I possibly can, because, you know, your opportunity to see a giant 4 foot wide, 40 foot long human colon just doesn't come along every day. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, and I'd love to talk with you, so give me a call at 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. I want to start out by talking about a conversation I had with a patient the other day that got me thinking along ecological lines. And on the way in this morning, I was trying to draw a diagram in my head, and it got too complicated very rapidly, so I'll have to do it later. But sort of, you remember the carbon cycle or the water cycle or any of those things that they made you study, and I think it was geology mostly where they taught you that. Well, I was going to do a money and input-output cycle for healthcare and see if that taught me anything about, what I know very well, but I haven't really taken a step back and looked at systematically. Thought it might be fun. What prompted this was a conversation I had yesterday with one of my patients. We were talking about the relative merits of Prilosec and Nexium. Now, Nexium is the second purple pill, or the son of the first purple pill. Prilosec was the original purple pill. And when I use these terms, I'm talking about the nicknames that the pharmaceutical companies give their drugs in order to make them familiar and desirable. And, of course, we all know about the drug ads, so I won't go into too much detail except to say that this level of marketing has been fueled by 40 years of intense behaviorist research, and they're very, very good at it. It was such a colossal bad move on the part of the FDA to let companies do direct-to-consumer advertising. And the results have been, you know, a doubling of pharmaceutical profits, which is just a wonderful thing for the healthcare system. So anyway, we were talking about Prilosec, which will cost you over-the-counter about $40 a month, and Nexium, which, if you had to buy it, would cost you around $250 a month. But in the case of this person, she wanted me to write a prescription for Nexium because it was on her plan's formulary, and it only cost her $30 a month. And $10, that's $10 that I'm getting back out of the system that I'm paying them hundreds of dollars a month for my health care, so I'd like to advantage myself where I can. Well, okay, so I talked to her about the fact that the drugs were basically equivalent, and I gave her prescription for Nexium because, you know, what am I going to do here? Then the next discussion was about whether or not when open enrollment comes up, she should switch her health plans. And she said, you know, my health plan costs have just been going up so much, and I want to switch over to the HMO, which will be cheaper for me. And besides, my husband's very sick with Crohn's disease, and we'll have better coverage for him. And so we're just asking all the doctors if they'll let them sign up as primary carers, and also as the specialists, if they'll continue to see them before we make this switch, because it'll save us some money. And I thought it was very polite of her to actually ask, because most people just generally assume, correctly, as it happens, that if you're my patient, you can continue to be my patient regardless of your payment status. I don't know how much longer I can do that, but basically that has been my policy because it seems like the right thing to do. Unfortunately, no good deed goes unpunished, but I'm not here to go off into a segue on healthcare costs and, you know, how the doctors are being squeezed. What I really want to talk about is something a bit more profound, which is that this patient wasn't closing the loop in her own mind between her desire to spend $180, let's say, of her health plan's money a month in order to save herself $10, and the fact that that might feed back on her health plan costs the following year. She just wasn't thinking in terms of a system. And, you know, if you were to take a look at the drugs that you're taking, and if we were all to do this is one of those things where we all have to do it, like not littering, like buying cars that get good gas mileage, like paying the extra 25 cents a gallon or whatever we pay in California for the cleaner gasoline. If we were to all like do generics on our plans wherever we could, or do the over-the-counters where they were available, our healthcare system costs wouldn't go up as quickly. We'd be in a more balanced ecological situation. We wouldn't have this positive feedback loop, and we'd all benefit. But we'd all like have to make that leap of faith that if we actually went for the cheaper drug, we would not be disadvantaged, and in fact, our entire tribe would be advantaged. We'd have to think like a collective, like the British do. We'll come back to the British in a minute, because some very interesting data came out in the last couple of weeks about the English, the British in general, actually, and their health status compared to Americans. But before that, I'd like to take our first caller and give out our phone numbers. They are 476-2800 and 1-800-655-5877. And we're going to go now to Rose in Monterey. Hello, Rose. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
My issue is last weekend, as a matter of fact, I started having a pain from my in the back of my knee going down to the inside of the calf.
Mm-hmm.
So bad. I could not touch it. So my first thought was, DVT, because I also was recovering from surgery 3 weeks prior.
Well, that was a good first thought. So what did you do?
So I ended up in ER, and they did the venous ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out that the arteries looked good, no clot.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was diagnosed with is a Baker's cyst.
More accurately, a ruptured Baker's cyst.
Oh, well, he didn't say that.
Yeah, but it's leaking, and that's why it hurts so much.
Oh, and the swelling.
Uh-huh.
It's just enormous. Now, it traveled down to the ankle.
Mm-hmm.
The ankle does not hurt, but it's just very swollen. But the calf, extremely painful, especially when I bear weight on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I don't know what to do. He gave me Vicodin.
Well, unless you have a history of ulcers,
no,
or you're on blood thinners, an anti-inflammatory medication, this is really a situation for ibuprofen or one of the pharmaceutical anti-inflammatories.
Okay.
Warm compresses, elevation.
Warm. Oh, okay.
Yeah, elevation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what you've got is you've got inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. By the way, I said warm compresses, but if you really find that cold works better for you, use cold. But
okay.
In general, if you can stand it, I think, and the warm does help with the pain, I think it'll help resolve it a little faster.
Oh, all
okay.
right.
What you're looking at is, you know what a Bible bump or a ganglion cyst is? People get them in the wrist.
Yes.
They get these little
yes.
lumps.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
it's a degenerative condition where the mm-hmm. joint, it gets a lot of activity, and the synovial sac, let's call it the joint sac,
mm-hmm.
stretches out in one spot. It's kind of a little hernia. Kind of the elasticity goes, it gets a little bit bigger, mm-hmm. gets a little bigger, makes its way up to the surface and blows up into a balloon. And a Baker's cyst is analogous. It's a degenerative condition of the knee joint. It's synovial. And so it forms a big bubble, most of which people aren't even aware of, although occasionally you'll get people who feel them
mm-hmm.
As pressure in the back of the knee after they run or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, the only time people know they have a Baker's cyst is when they rupture.
Uh-huh.
And so you should, sometimes after a walk, sometimes may just have been just lying in bed and putting pressure on it, but for whatever reason, your cyst decided to rupture, and the fluid inside is very irritating to the surrounding tissue. And so you get a massive inflammatory response. It's kind of a foreign body response.
Uh-huh.
If someone were to inject some kind of oil or something into your muscle tissue that wasn't supposed to be there, your immune system would rush
in. It feels like a giant water balloon.
Yeah, exactly. So what you've got is you've got the inflammatory phase of the reaction, which, when did this happen?
A week ago.
Okay. It's a little late for anything but pharmaceuticals at this point. Early on, sometimes you can nab an inflammatory reaction with some particular acupuncture treatments, but you have to get to it quickly. Once it's got momentum, you're not likely to be successful. I have used that with success on myself, however, so I will go on record saying that these acupuncture ting point treatments really do work for acute inflammation.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, the bottom line here is that you're going to be laid up for a while, and you should worry about DVTs, actually, because now...
Oh, really? Still, even though it was not...
Well, the trouble is now you're going to be laid up more. So it's just the act of being laid up that puts you at risk. So,
oh, I see where you're going.
So what I'm saying is wiggle those ankles a lot, massage the area, keep it elevated. If you can stand a wrap an ace bandage around it,
I just wanted to throw that in. I have pet stockings at home.
If you can stand to wear them, they will help.
Okay.
It's more along the lines of some people find the pressure too intense and can't tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can stand to do them, that will work, and pumping the ankle a lot will work, even though it'll probably hurt. Use the Vicodin so you get some sleep.
Yeah.
And, like I said, an anti-inflammatory.
Mm-hmm.
And typically... anti-inflammatory dosing is, you know, what they say on the over-the-counter is for pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure the legality of telling you what one would normally use for inflammation, so I'm not going to do that on the air, because that might constitute a professional consultation. But I bet you have a doctor you could ask.
Yeah, well, what I have at home, I'm sorry to interrupt, it's a leaf. And if I take two, that helps momentarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have a doctor, a regular one?
Well, not an orthopedic.
No. Do you have a regular doctor?
Yeah.
So ask your doctor, you know, just leave a message, get a call back. What would be my maximum safe dose of Aleve to use?
Okay.
And get that from someone who's actually got an official relationship with you, because right now I'm dealing with lawyers, and it's made me paranoid. Okay? That's what talking to lawyers does.
Okay.
It's a law of nature.
You know, by talking to other people about it, I was... Well, you probably have to have it aspirated, and sometimes surgery required. And so now here I'm going, oh my goodness, how did I get myself into this situation?
Actually, it's basically drained itself.
I think that's
why you have all of your inflammation. Aspirating them sometimes is done when they're just causing pressure symptoms, but it's gone and self-drained. So,
I'm hoping for that.
If you're, you know, the good news is it will probably not heal up as a cyst. It will probably heal up as a scar and not fill up again and not ever do this again.
Mm.
So you have a good shot once you get through this rough patch of a good recovery.
Extremely uncomfortable.
I'm so sorry. Anyway, that's why the good Lord made Vicodin.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just needed to be reassured that there's nothing life-threatening going on.
Oh, no, I don't think so. Oh, by the way, when you do take the Vicodin, take some laxative or a stool softener with it. Those are over-the-counter. Because the most common complication I see in people over 50 with any painful condition is that they end up paralyzing their bowel with the pain pills.
Oh, and then you create another problem.
And then you create another problem. And it's just this cascade of one thing after another. So be a little proactive with the stool softeners.
Okay. I'll have that handy, too.
All righty.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Dominican Hospital Foundation, licensed to offer charitable gift annuities with lifetime incomes. Information is online at DominicanHospital.org or by phone 831-462-7712. KUSP's annual radio auction takes place June 3rd through June 10th. Your participation in this event helps KUSP raise needed funds. A complete catalog of auction items will be available after May 15th. Check online at KUSP.org or call 476-2800. Let's go to our next caller now, and it is Glenn from Santa Cruz. Hello, Glenn. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, nice to talk to you, and I want to say how much I love your scientific attitude.
Thank you.
It's much appreciated. I've been taking statins for 10 years, and I've recently developed peripheral neuropathy in my foot with no apparent cause. I'm not diabetic. I'm not overweight by more than 15 pounds, and I'm in good health. And so I was, you know, the only thing that I've come up with is that, there's some talk about a relationship to statins and peripheral neuropathy, but I'm not getting word on that from my doctor or my cardiologist.
Where did you hear about it?
Let's see. A friend referred me to a study from UC San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
I read that, and I see other places on the web where people have reported, you know, that they think that statin drugs are implicated in their peripheral neuropathy.
Well, it's a new side effect from my standpoint. It's not one I've heard before. I'm going to turn you down for just second because there's a lot of background noise.
Okay, I'll go sit in a quieter place in the gym then.
Oh, that would be good.
Okay.
Anyway, so it's a new thing as far as I'm aware. I will go ahead and do a little web search on it and see how credible the data is.
Huh.
When you talk about people having experience on the, you know, associations on the internet, you always have to be really careful with that one because people will always associate whatever they're doing differently with whatever happens to them.
Right.
This is called superstitious behavior, and we do it all the time. I didn't throw salt over my shoulder, and then I sprained my ankle.
Right, yeah.
You know, and we won't notice the times we didn't throw salt over our shoulder and did, you know, had nothing go wrong. And so you end up with this, actually really fascinating studies. If you look up superficial behavior, their superstitious behavior in animals, there's some wonderful things that the early behaviorists did with rats in the 60s where they basically had rats doing the cha-cha and crossing themselves before they ate just because that's what they were rewarding, and the rats went through these elaborate rituals, and people will do that too. So you want to see some actual comparative data. And the problem that you run into with any kind of a statin study is comorbidity, because people who are on statins have usually have elevated cholesterol. They often have other health problems like diabetes or prediabetes, or which I know you've said you didn't have.
Right.
But the problem is the person who makes this real persuasive case on the web for their neuropathy being caused by their Zocor may also have been diabetic for 3 years and not realize it, or something like that. And so it can be a little bit problematic. I will look and see what credible data there is.
Mm.
Now, what we normally do when a person develops peripheral neuropathy, what I believe should happen, is a series of things. First of all, a check for tertiary syphilis, which is an RPR test. It's a blood test. A check for their B vitamin levels, and the best test for that is something called methylmalonic acid and a serum B12. And if those levels are both within normal limits, then you know it probably isn't something that's B vitamin related neuropathy.
Now, there's something there that I just recently switched primary care physicians, and my previous one, I had high homocysteine levels, and so I was taking folic acid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was not doing enough, so he said, okay, let's add in some vitamin. I think it was B12.
Mm-hmm.
And he recommended just take B50 vitamin pills from Costco.
Mm-hmm.
They have high levels of lots of B vitamins.
Right.
So I've been doing that for about 3 months.
Has it affected has your homocysteine come down at all?
Yeah, they got down below 10.
Okay.
Like 9.2 or something.
Okay.
And so that was good, but my new primary care physician said, oh, you could be getting an overdose of B vitamins and that could be causing this. And I went, oh, really? So, you know, he said, stop taking the B vitamins. Well,
I'm going to disagree with your primary care doctor on record on
yeah.
that one. But I'll tell you what may be happening is you may be a mutant. We're all mutants, so don't worry about it. But there are some mutations we've actually identified, and there is one that's related to neuropathy called the MTFR mutation. And there is a cheap, probably under $100 blood test for it. Quest, which is the local lab, does it. And I order it in people who have high levels of homocysteine or who have any evidence whatsoever that something is messed up with their B12. With their nerves. And yeah. So it's called the MTFR. That stands for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. Anyway, just write down MTFR. Don't worry about that. Anything else, and your doctor can look that up through the Quest Lab and order it.
Okay.
And you should check. You may have that mutation, and if you have that mutation, it means that your entire adult life you've had abnormalities in your B12 metabolism that can have aged your nerves prematurely, just the same way as if you were a heavy drinker all your life.
Which I used to be, but that was a long time ago.
Yeah, but suppose you were a heavy drinker a long time ago and you had this mutation. You could have put 50,000 miles on your nerves in your 20s.
Mm.
And so now what you're getting is an 80-year-old, it's like a joke setup, okay? An 80-year-old walks into my office and says, "Doctor, I can't feel my toes." And, you know, the doctor says, "Can you reach your toes?" And that's basically, if you're 80 years old and you have peripheral neuropathy, it's like you're old and your nerves are old and this is what happens, and we don't chase it because it's common if you have old nerves. You've got younger nerves, but maybe you prematurely aged them because of this genetic vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
So get that test. Get that test. Make sure you've had the other stuff that I mentioned, especially the syphilis test, and you said you weren't diabetic. So those are the those are the big three. And then if it's truly a peripheral neuropathy, it affects both feet and to roughly the same distance. If it's one-sided, there may be a contribution from some pressure on the nerve at the disc level.
Right. Well, actually, I'm feeling it in my left foot only, but now I'm just barely getting indications that it's showing up on my right foot.
One foot can be ahead of the other, but it should be symmetrically across the foot.
And both feet are hairless.
Your circulation's okay? They've checked that?
They haven't checked that yet, no.
Yeah, they need to check the circulation, make sure the arteries down there are feeding the nerves.
Because
that could be another thing that puts an undue strain on them.
Okay.
Sounds like there's a little few things on your to-do list.
All right, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Very helpful. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, and let's go now to Susie in Castroville. Hello, Susie, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Dr. Dawn. Home of the artichoke, yes. Our festival is coming up next weekend. So
free PSA here on KUSP.
I had a drug reaction last, I guess it was September or something like that, where I fell and I guess I blacked out. And when I fell, I landed on my arm, you know, in a very awkward position, obviously, because what happened when I woke up a couple hours later or came to a couple of hours later, my shoulder was, I noticed that it was just, you know, lots of pain in it.
Let me stop you for a second. You fell and you were knocked out for several hours?
Yeah, it's one of those mysteries that I've never been able to figure out. I was on a couple meds that I was 2 days. I hadn't taken my dosage of this certain medication for 2 days, and I was on my way to get it actually when 2 o'clock in the afternoon I just fell and just. I don't know why. It's one of those mysteries, and I told my doctor about it, and it's like, I don't know. You probably have to know the drugs I take.
Let's go on with your question, but let me just say that an unexplained loss of consciousness, if you fell and hit your head enough to knock yourself out?
No, I didn't hit my head, and the only reason I know that is because I didn't have a bruise, it wasn't hurt, wasn't bleeding,
So that means that you were out for 2 hours for no apparent reason.
Actually, it was more than that. It was like, you know, about maybe, in the afternoon, it was like eight at night or something, or seven at night.
I don't care how old you are or what drugs you were taking, that needs a workup, okay? An unexplained loss of consciousness.
Yeah,
you have to be checked out for epilepsy.
Yeah.
You need an EEG, no matter what drugs you were on.
Let me write that down. EEG and a what?
Just say you should be checked for epilepsy.
Oh.
Any competent physician will know what that involves. But even if the drugs, you know, caused you to like have a low blood pressure, if typically when a person faints from low blood pressure, they might be down for five minutes.
Yeah.
Not hours.
I know. It's like I thought, that's the weird thing, the fact that I fell And usually, you know, if I was conscious, obviously I just get up.
Right.
I didn't.
So you fell because you were unconscious and you lost consciousness.
Well, I felt like my legs went out from underneath me, and that's kind of what I remember. And then, I wasn't still conscious when I was on the floor.
It bothers me you were that down that long, and I think that needs to be investigated a little more thoroughly. But let's get to your actual question.
Yeah,
okay.
That was weird. It's a mystery. Anyway, so what happened was when I woke up, time went by, and my shoulder had been hurting for ever since that fall.
And it wasn't hurting before the fall?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
No. And I think I just fell on it funny. Mm-hmm. And and laid on it for a couple hours. And I went to my doctor, and he gave me a couple of shots first a shot of cortisone, and then a couple months later, that helped, by the way, the cortisone shot. And then a couple months later, the pain came back, and he gave me another shot, and then it helped. So, but now I'm thinking now it's the pain starting to come back, and he thinks it's a bursae. Am I saying that right?
Yep.
Bursa
singular.
That's in my shoulder, and I don't know what is a bursa. I thought it was a tendon or a ligament or a cartilage thing, but he said no, it's a bursa, which is kind of in between the shoulder cuff.
If you take your fingers and you walk them out along your collarbone, as if the collarbone were a diving board, you know, you walk out to the edge of the diving board of the collarbone, and then you drop your finger off the diving board, there's a spot there, it's kind of soft, and that's where you can feel the subacromial bursa. A bursa is a shock absorber pad, and it also acts as a lubricant. So think about those gel pads that you put in your shoes sometimes, and you know how slippery they are. So something can slide over a bursa, back and forth over it, and it's protected from being eroded away. You think about a tendon, wherever a tendon has to ride over a bone, the tendon is a rope, and if you just rub a rope across a rock, what happens to the rope? Eventually it starts to fray. So the bursas form in the body it's part of the design, but it's there functionally to act as a lubricant so that the tendon is rubbing across the bursa, which is just fine with that, and doesn't fray.
Right.
So in the case of a bursitis, usually because of a direct blow, sometimes because of repetitive strain, the bursa becomes inflamed because it got smushed between the two bones.
Right.
And so now it's irritated and has a tendency to get irritated. It hasn't fully recovered, even though you've backed it off with the steroids a couple of times.
Right.
So now it's a weak spot.
And so you're saying it's inflamed?
I'm saying you're starting to feel pain there because the inflammation may be coming back.
In the bursa.
Now, it can be difficult to distinguish between something called impingement and bursitis, and the two often coexist. There is also a situation where the tendon that holds the supraspinatus tendon most commonly, which runs right under that acromium, gets irritated, and then you have a tendinitis and a bursitis. And all of these things kind of fall under the global rubric of rotator cuff syndrome.
Because that's what he said it was. Yeah.
The whole structure is called the rotator cuff, and you can have variants on that. It responds well to physical therapy and stretching, particularly stretching the chest wall muscles, without having examined you or done your specific flavor of it. I could tell you that the mainstay of treatment in my book is range of motion exercises when you're not symptomatic, to keep the shoulder loosened up.
I've been doing that very regularly.
Okay. Yeah. So you may need some additional physical therapy. There may be an imbalance. The fact that it's coming back suggests that there's some kind of driver in your behavior or in your structure that are leading it not to resolve completely. That you've flared it up, it's not going away.
Right, which, you know, why would it anyway? I mean, even if you stretch it out, it makes it feel better, but, you know, then it comes back.
When you stretch something, if you stretch it long enough and hard enough and often enough, you alter its structure.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so
just kind of keep at it?
I think you should see a physical therapist or go back to your doctor. I think a good physiatrist or physical therapist, and then really assiduously trying to strengthen what's weak, stretch what's tight, and, you know, optimize the position of the upper arm bone, the humerus, in that cup-like structure that we call the shoulder socket.
So, how do you optimize it?
Well, for one thing, most people have tight pectorals and weak shoulder blade muscles.
Right.
So you stretch the pectorals and tighten the shoulder blades, and you concentrate on posture, and you don't spend all your time sitting at a computer terminal hunched forward, because that just aggravates the abnormality in the structure.
Okay.
So I think it's, you know, now you've got something that's a chronic vulnerability. You're going to need to work your behavior around it, and that behavior probably needs to include some fairly thorough, regular, daily work on the musculature until you've got it, you know, rebuilt, and that could take 6 months to a year.
It's already been almost 9 months.
But you may not have been doing the right things, so we would start the clock from now.
Oh, I see what you're saying, so the physical therapist would know exactly.
Right, and then you'd need to keep at it and on your own. Because you don't need, you're grown up, you don't need a babysitter anymore.
Can I ask you, my doctor suggested a CT just to see exactly if it is the bursae. And would that, you know, I know it's very expensive, and I'm thinking, is knowing what it is, that would that be helpful? Or, you know, like you said, it could be my tendonitis, it could be the bursae, it could be something else.
Well, let me put it this way.
So we don't know for sure if it's the bursae, but he thinks it is.
Let me put it this way. I never order an MRI to see what's there. I order an MRI when I have something that I know needs surgery.
No, this is a CT, he said, not an MRI.
Okay. Imaging study.
Right.
Let's substitute. I don't think an imaging study is worthwhile unless you're planning on operating on somebody, or there are findings on the exam that suggest something like a tear of that supraspinatus tendon.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, and this is true of backs as well, because, you know, I believe in voodoo, and I believe that you can psych yourself out, and I believe that if you know that you have an abnormal MRI, you change your behavior, and you change your expectations. And I honestly think that MRIs, when they're done indiscriminately, or CT scans when they're done indiscriminately, can make people fear their own bodies and take a pessimistic viewpoint. Oh, I've got arthritis, my life is over, I need to modify my behavior. And I've just seen too many people turn into people with disease because they had, let's say, a CT or an MRI for something else, and this was an incidental finding, and it wasn't bothering them until they really knew it was there.
Well, that seems kind of, I mean, I don't know. I'm actually kind of...
Can you reach up with your bad shoulder and scratch the opposite ear? Can you reach over your head and scratch the opposite ear right now?
With my bad shoulder, okay, opposite ear, my right ear.
Reach up, you know, can you reach up over, you can reach up and scratch your...
Yeah.
Can you reach up and scratch your shoulder blade with that same arm?
The right shoulder blade?
Yeah, either one. If you can get your arm behind you and up to the shoulder blade.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of different, you know, I would have to see you physically, but...
You can fasten a bra?
When I go to, like, serve, like in tennis.
Yeah, okay.
That kind of motion, you know, when you take your racket back.
Right,
that,
okay.
I can't do that.
What about fastening your bra? From behind.
Yeah, I can do that, okay. But I usually turn it around and
you're not disabled enough for an imaging study, in my opinion.
Okay.
And I would discourage you from getting one.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I just would like to know for sure what it is. That's all.
Why?
Well,
why
because.
If it doesn't affect...
Then I would know really the best course to take.
But I've already told you the best course to take, and this applies to any of the 6 or 7 possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment's the same.
You think it'd be the same?
Yep.
So he might do surgery is what he was saying.
That's right. If you have an abnormal CT or MRI, you have justification for surgery.
Well,
you're not disabled enough for surgery.
And you're thinking that wouldn't be I wouldn't need that.
We do way too much surgery on shoulders.
Okay.
And it's like whoopee, we found an abnormality on the MRI. Let's operate. I mean, that's the current prevailing attitude. I'm doing my very best to keep people from getting the CT or the MRI in the first place, because then they think they need surgery to fix it. And that's garbage. And and you end up, first of all, putting yourself under the knife. You never have the same structure again. You may not need surgery. You never had a problem before until you fell on the thing. Well, that's the proximate cause.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, you know, the idea that you're like a vehicle that needs, you know, to have something repaired or replaced...
Mm-hmm.
Wrong-headed, and I just, you know, it's a slippery slope. You get the imaging study, then you've psyched yourself out, and you know you've got the abnormalities. You kind of are expecting the physical therapy to fail, and you don't work as hard, and you end up, you know, being a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Would it help the physical therapist to know what is exactly is wrong?
I don't think so. I think your exam will tell exactly what's wrong with your shoulder.
My exam.
Yeah, the physical exam, where your restrictions are.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
I don't think you need an imaging study, and I would discourage it in a person who has a small amount. You're annoyed by this. This is not disabling.
Yeah, I'm annoyed. And as far as cortisone, what do you think? It's kind of bad for you, I know, and
I don't think you're doing the right stuff, and I've already told you what I think the right stuff is. And when you have a bad flare, then is the time to think about cortisone, and then you go back and go, why did I flare it? What was I not doing right?
Oh, I see. But, I mean, that's what I'm asking you. Would you, periodically continue with cortisone?
No. You use that. You save that in reserve. That's your fire extinguisher for bad flare-ups, and that's
well,
all
otherwise,
it's for.
Otherwise, just physical therapy, stretching, that kind of thing.
I'm sorry it's so simple and low-tech.
Oh, no, that's okay.
It's not romantic.
I'm wanting to get clear.
Yeah. Good
okay,
luck.
Good. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay. Let's take just a moment and remind you that Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from John F. Kennedy University's Graduate School of Professional Psychology in Campbell, offering a master's degree in counseling psychology designed for busy adults. Information available at 800-868-2359. KUSP's Live at Lunch music sessions are now available as podcasts on KUSP.org. These sessions are recorded live in our studios and broadcast at KUSP. Podcasting is free and allows these downloads to be automatically downloaded to your computer. Just go to KUSP.org and click podcasts to find instructions. And I also want to point out that this program is also podcast, and that's one way to find it. Another way is to go to AskDrDawn.com and or go to NPR.com. Many ways to get registered for the podcast. We also place the show up there for your pleasure in downloading, and any interviews are maintained in our archives indefinitely. So I hope that you will take advantage of all of this wonderful internet stuff. Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from Well Within Spa. Well Within offers massage therapy, face and body care in private spa rooms overlooking a Japanese garden in downtown Santa Cruz. Information available at 458-WELL and online at wellwithinspa.com. Let's go now to our next caller, and that is Judith in Watsonville. Hello, Judith, and welcome.
Hi. One sort of correction from a previous caller, and then I have the topic that I wanted to bring up.
Go ahead.
Is you were talking about the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase test.
Yes.
And you said MTFR, and it's MTHFR, the initials. I thought that might be helpful.
Thank you for the correction.
To have all the initials in. And what I was calling about is that May, in California, the legislature has declared May to be Lyme disease awareness month.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about some prevention issues related to Lyme disease, since the Lyme organism is endemic in ticks in this region.
Still, thank goodness, at a low percentage rate.
And another part of it that I wanted to really encourage. There seems a lot of controversy about Lyme disease among the medical community these days, and among people. And one of the things that has been introduced in Congress is there's two different bills. There's a House bill and then a companion Senate bill. And the House bill is H.R. 3427, Smith and Kelly. And the Senate bill is S. 1479, Christopher Dodd and Rick Santorum, which would set up calls for money to invest in oversight and research related and education related to Lyme disease. And I just really want to encourage people to invite their representative and congresspeople to support and co-sponsor those bills.
Okay. Well, I haven't read the bills, but the idea is that we're going to do oversight. That makes
for
me
research nervous. It's to do research and education related
okay.
to Lyme disease.
All right.
And it's one of the things that's really it's sort of out of balance right now is like there are reported cases, for example, of West Nile virus compared to Lyme disease. There's about 19,000 reported cases of Lyme disease and there's only about 2,500 of West Nile virus, whereas...
And so what?
But done
what?
On the Lyme disease, they're only spending, you know, they're
okay,
spending much
wait a
less money compared to what they're spending on West Nile virus.
All right, this isn't a health question. You have a political position here.
It's related to an epidemic that's impacting the state and the country. And
okay, it's a major epidemic on the East Coast. It's a major epidemic in some places. It's actually not a major epidemic locally, so I object to your use of that terminology. I do believe that it's an important, what we call an emerging disease, and of course more research needs to be done. Now, did you actually have a question?
Well, I was hoping you would talk about prevention related issues to Lyme disease.
I'll be happy to do that. That was the main health particular thing. Good. Okay, so let's do that. Lyme disease is caused by a tick, and so the big way not to get Lyme disease is not to get a tick bite in the first place, and if you do get a tick, to have that tick be found quickly, not stay on your body for 24 hours or so, which is about how long it takes to be transmitted. Now, I have only seen a few cases of Lyme disease rash since in the 15 years I've been here. I've seen about the number that I should see based on the prevalence of the disease locally. And none of the people who had the classic rash, which is only present in maybe 80% of people with Lyme disease, and then only for about 24 hours on the average, so easy to miss. That's the tip of the iceberg. But those people with the rash had no recollection of a tick bite. So even if you don't remember the tick or don't see the tick, these are itty-bitty guys and you can have them. So you want to assume that the ticks are out there and they want to jump on you. And you want to, when you are in the woods, any place where basically deer mice are, which is pretty much the forests around here. But the more rural you are, the more up in the woods you are, the more of a risk you're looking at in terms of just the actual ticks themselves and where they live. But you can get it in the backyard, too. So you've got children running around, you're abutting onto the woods in Ben Lomond. You need to, when you bathe your children at night, look at them all over under a bright light and look for ticks. The ticks themselves are small, and they're about the size of a sesame seed. So that, just to give you an idea of what you're looking for, and they're black. Sometimes if you've got really good eyes, you can see markings. Prevention involves the use of insecticides, either on your clothing or on your body. I am in favor of on the clothing. And I like to use the chrysanthemum derivatives, but the natural chrysanthemum derivative, the permethrin, is my favorite because that one has the least likelihood of having bad toxic side effects to a small minority of the population. This is placed on the clothing, and then this will stay on the clothing for quite a while, cup through several washings, and it is considered safe for use in children. As long as they're old enough not to suck on their T-shirt, they're probably old enough to have this used. This can be found in a 1% spray for upholstery fabric. It's used for lice. When you get a kid with head lice, you're supposed to decontaminate the upholstery in the living room and wherever the kid might have been lying, the pillows, with this 1% stuff that's called RID. And you can use that on clothing and let it dry. And like I said, it'll last through several washings. Other things are long sleeves, long pants. Tuck your pants into the socks when you're going through knee-high grass. Most people aren't going to do these things, or they're going to forget. And so as a backup, if you've been out in the woods or out in the grass where the deer roam, please check yourself for ticks that night. Doesn't take long, less than 5 minutes, and you could prevent yourself getting the disease. We'll see if our caller is still on the line and has any other suggestions.
Well, that would, in terms of that prevention, that would basically be it. One of the things I guess that's all we'll do for now, and I thank you very much for helping with that. I guess one of the other things, I guess, would be very careful how you take the tick off, because if you take it off wrong, even if you take it off immediately, you can give yourself, if the tick's infected, you can push the infective agent into your system.
That is theoretically possible.
And so if you might talk a little bit about being careful to remove, how you remove the tick.
I generally advise people to let the doctor remove the tick.
But, oh, okay.
And just call and get in and get it removed. You've got 24 hours, so you just got to find it. If you take it with tweezers and pull straight out, grasping right at the skin, and pull straight out, you can rock just gently back and forth and often get it out. That's what I try first, and it works only half the time. So in general, the way I remove them is I take a little tiny 2-millimeter punch, and I do a punch biopsy. And I remove the tick mouth parts intact that way without any pressure on the tick.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Let's go now to Melita in Bradley. Hello, Melita.
Okay. Thank you. I have a question about immunization shots. I'm shortly going to be transferring to a university in the Midwest, Indiana University. Require some vaccinations of their students, and I was just kind of wanting to get your opinion about them and ask, because I've never had any vaccinations before, so I'd have to get them all for the first time now.
You're how old?
I'm 24.
24, and you've never been vaccinated for anything?
No.
Okay. Wow. That's all right. Let's start with what will kill you the most painfully and why you should be vaccinated for that. Tetanus. Okay. You need to be vaccinated several times because you have to do catch-up vaccine for tetanus. Tetanus is in the soil. It's in the dirt. If it gets into a wound or you poke or you get it in, if it gets into your body and finds a nice anaerobic low oxygen zone, that's why it's the classic puncture wound, you will die an extremely painful death, and you don't want to even hear the details. Imagine going into an epileptic seizure and staying there for 24 to 36 hours until your system just shuts down, and that'll come close. Oh, by the way, you're conscious too, so it hurts like crazy. You don't want to go there. Tetanus will kill you, and it's not, you can't ever escape that risk because it's in the soil. And it's also in many people's poop, for that matter, and most animals' poop. So you should be vaccinated against this. And this is not a dangerous vaccination, especially for an adult. But I think it's really important. I'm sorry?
I don't really want to argue with whether or not I should have the vaccines. I just wanted to be sure that there wasn't any risk to having them.
Compared to the risk of not having them?
No, risk to having the vaccines, considering my age, and I hadn't had them before. I just want to think about that.
All right. So the risks that you're looking at, you need to consider context. That's important. Whether you want to consider it or not, I'm going to frame my answer in context, which is the risk of the disease versus the risk of the vaccine. Okay? And I'm going to give it to you in a proportional risk. So,
okay.
And we're going to use death or disability as our, you know, or cancer, for example, as, you know, the things that we're going to talk about when we talk about risk, okay? The diseases that can kill you as an adult, definitely tetanus. Pertussis and diphtheria will probably make you uncomfortable but not kill you. So you could just do tetanus alone. I don't know what your university rules are. They probably assume you've had that vaccine. Let me continue. Hepatitis B is required by many universities. It's required by many school systems. And hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease. It's something you get if you have sex with an IV drug user, if you are an IV drug user, or if you're a healthcare worker and you get splashed with blood. Hence, teachers who might have to deal with a nosebleed are generally advised and sometimes required in some school districts to get hepatitis B. And many universities require it as well because sexual experimentation is common on university campuses even today. So that might be a requirement. I'm not sure if there'd be an out for you, but obviously your risk of from hepatitis B is getting a bad case of hepatitis that kills you or getting a mild case and then 20 years later having liver cancer. And so that's the hepatitis B risk. And the risk of the vaccine, let's call the hepatitis B risk 1. The risk of the vaccine is about a 10,000th. So it's actually a very safe vaccine. It cannot give you the disease. Complications beyond a sore arm are virtually unheard of. All right. Then the next one that they may require is meningococcus, meningitis vaccine. Some universities only require that if you're going to be in the dorms. Some don't require it at all. Meningitis is something that you get from the nasal secretions of your roommate. And so since some people are carriers and do not get sick, there will be epidemics in military barracks and in dormitories. So they've started recommending meningitis vaccine and sometimes requiring it. It, too, is not a live virus vaccine. And as an adult, you have virtually no risk from any of the preservatives unless you have an idiosyncratic reaction, which is extremely rare, like one in a million. But the preservative issue relates to children. And as an adult, you've already had more industrial waste through your body and processed it since you're still going off to college. You still have brain cells. You know, the minuscule hit that you're going to get in terms of any preservatives in a vaccination is really not worth considering as an absolute risk. Measles, mumps, and rubella. You've heard about the mumps epidemic that's going right now in the Midwest?
Yes.
Now, those are in mostly vaccinated people. A new strain of mumps has come from England, and apparently the immune system that's been previously vaccinated, it isn't working as well. We had a similar thing happen with measles about 15, 20 years ago. And so we know that our measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is not good. I do want to put in a push for rubella. Are you ever planning to have babies?
Well, it's not something I've really thought about at this point.
If you are pregnant and you have not had a rubella vaccine and you encounter rubella, child, neighbor, something like that, your baby will be born, most likely if it survives, with severe birth defects. Rubella is really gnarly if you get it while you're pregnant. And it's not gnarly for you, it's gnarly for the baby. You may not even know. You may think you had the flu. And then you have this baby born with these very characteristic abnormalities, mental retardation, heart valve issues, gnarly stuff that you should think about that. And you don't want to get vaccinated after you're pregnant or while you're not using contraception. So that might be a good reason to get an MMR right there.
Okay, but you don't think that there are any particular issues I should be worried about with that one, as I've not had a vaccine for it before? Or?
No, because as we have people in migrating to the United States who have never been vaccinated and get vaccinated as adults. So we have got the catch-up schedule. We studied it. It's pretty much known how to do it. And adults are much safer getting vaccines than children because we don't have that overreactive immune system to deal with.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for letting me know about this. I was just concerned particularly with the measles, mumps, rubella, because I thought of these as mostly things that were given to children, and I didn't know how it was for adults to get it. So thank you very much for your information.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let me add that one caller wanted to emphasize that physical therapy for shoulder problems is the main treatment and did work for her. Let's go quickly to Chris in Marina. Hello, Chris. We don't have much time, but I thought it was important to take your call.
Okay, thank you. I had an incident a couple weeks ago, and I haven't been able to learn what or why exactly happened.
How old are you?
I'm 57.
57, go ahead.
And I got up during the night to use the bathroom, and while I was standing, I fell three times within a minute or two. I did not lose consciousness, and what it was like, it was as though all my muscles just decided to shut down. I just collapsed in a pile, I wasn't able to brace myself or... Mm-hmm. And I protect myself, and I didn't have any symptoms before it happened. I felt perfectly fine. I just all of a sudden was on the floor, got up, and within a few seconds it happened again, and then it happened again. And after the third time, I was able to go back to bed, not feeling very well, but I went back to bed and went back to sleep.
Didn't feel dizzy, didn't feel like you were about to faint.
No, none of that.
No presyncopal things.
Uh-huh.
Heartbeat seemed regular. You didn't have any strong pounding heartbeat or anything weird like that?
No.
No shortness of breath?
No.
Okay. And this has never happened before?
No.
All right. Next question. Any chemical substances, new herbs, new drugs, recreational substances, anything like that on board at the time within the last 24 hours?
No.
Okay, you don't take any pharmaceuticals?
I do take prescribed medicines, but everything I had taken, I had been taking for months or years.
Okay.
So nothing new.
All right. Go look at the PDR, or the package inserts on all of your prescribed medicines, and see if muscle weakness is listed. just to be sure, because occasionally somebody will drink a bunch of grapefruit juice and not metabolize something, and they'll get a side effect that on a drug they've been taking for years because of a food-drug interaction. It's very rare, but this is pretty rare, so you have to start what we call zebra hunting in medicine.
Uh-huh.
The other zebra, which this sounds exactly like, I don't know if this is it, but it's something called periodic paralysis. And it's a sudden onset muscle weakness related to, it's actually hereditary, but it's related to potassium. And if you can see someone, if you'd gone to the doctor or the ER that night and they checked your potassium, it probably would have been low. And so that's the only other entity that immediately comes to the top of my brain as being a possibility. Let's see.
The potassium level fluctuate?
Well, it's not supposed to.
I have routine blood tests. And
it's not supposed to, but in this particular hereditary entity, that's exactly what it does do. And it'll erratically flip out on you. I don't remember what the usual triggers are. It's
my
not
mom's gone to the hospital a few times for that reason.
Ah, the plot thickens. So that's starting to sound like maybe you actually have this. It's one of these things that in my brain is just there on the differential, and I'd have to look up how you work it up, and I don't have a computer or the internet here at my disposal. But I think that might be a useful line of pursuit. So it's called familial periodic paralysis.
Okay.
And maybe you want to look that up and pull an article off Medscape or Mayo Family Clinic or something like that, and take that into your doctor and see about working yourself up for it.
Okay, great.
Anyway, that's kind of spooky, and I'm glad it's only happened once. If it happens again, try to get into a medical facility where they can draw your blood and ask for a serum potassium level.
Okay.
Okay? I do think that has to be done while it's still fresh in order to be useful.
Yeah, at this time, I didn't call the doc until a day later.
I
didn't see anyone for like 2 days later.
Exactly, but now you know you need to do that.
Okay. Yeah, it was kind of scary.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can sort of relate to the kind of scary thing. I'm surprised. Do you not have health insurance?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, next time, honey, hit the 911 button and get them to draw blood while they're carrying you in the ambulance. They can draw a vial and then test that for potassium, and that's your best shot.
Uh-huh. Okay. How soon does it need to be drawn
Well, as soon as possible. I don't know the answer. I'm going to have to sign you off now.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you. You've been listening to Ask Dr. Dawn, and Ask Dr. Dawn is, well, what you've been listening to. I hope that you will listen next week, and I hope that you've enjoyed this program. I'll look up the thing on Zocor and peripheral neuropathy, and if you have any other issues or interests, please be sure to call back next week. And until then, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.